Hello and welcome to the talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday the 14th of September 2024. I do hope you're all well and looking forward to autumn, even if we hadn't had much of a summer this year. The time it has come, the work has begun to be free or forever be slaves. The music I've chosen this week is a little unusual. It's originally a folk song dating back to 1838 as one of the Manchester broadsides, but you'd hardly know it. The title is a new song on the great demonstration which is to be made on Kersal Moor, September 24th, 1838. It's arranged and played by a folk reggae band called Edward II, in a style more reminiscent of Jimmy Cliff or Zoot and the Maytals than a traditional folk group. They've generously allowed us to use it on Talking News. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. This week, as usual, we have the news stories and radio listings, and then a rundown of television programmes that offer audio description. In 10 Today, we continue the second series of gentle exercise routines to help keep you active at home, and this will be followed by Today in History, where we hear about events that took place this week in the past. Next up is our new regular feature from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. We have two stories this week about rooks and about swallows. Then we have a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first, called Hidden Spaces, is about a walk in the countryside around King's Langley, while the second is a profile of Frederick Sander, the Orchid King. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Sarah, Bob, Jenny and Liz.
Good morning, I'm Jenny, and my first article today is MP calls for end to unfair SEND funding system. Harpenden's MP has hit out at the unfair funding system for children with special needs, claiming it has created a lost generation of students. Speaking at a Westminster Hall debate, chaired by neighbouring MP for Hitchin, Alistair Strathern, Victoria Collins criticised Hertfordshire County Council, HCC, after Ofsted identified widespread systemic failings in its SEND provision. The service received the lowest rating possible, with some children waiting more than 78 weeks for help. Speaking in the debate last Thursday, Ms Collins blamed the Conservative-led council, as well as the flawed national funding formula that has seen the county receive the third lowest cash per high-needs child funding in the country. Raising an example from her constituency of Harpenden and Berkhamsted, she said, "One of my constituents, Charlotte, is a parent to three children, all with EHCPs, educational, health and care plans, and complex SEND needs. Being in constant battle mode has become the norm and resulted in her eldest child having to travel almost 100 miles a day to school. The emotional well-being of Charlotte and her children has taken a toll, and her youngest has barely attended school since October 2023. The funding model has been inherited by the Labour government from its Conservative predecessors, and Ms Collins used her speech to call on Children's Minister Janet Davey to change the formula used to calculate funding. Leader of Hearts County Council, Councillor Richard Roberts, said, "Our SEND services, like those delivered by other local authorities up and down the country, continue to face a perfect storm of underfunding and increasing need, understandably leading to delays and dissatisfaction. By delivering millions of pounds of additional investment and radically transforming the way in which we work, bringing in more staff with lived experience of SEND, we are genuinely turning a corner, delivering higher quality services, better overall outcomes and improved communication."
St Albans boxer Christian Fetty has hailed the support from his hometown after securing an impressive victory in his second professional fight. Christian, 22, won plaudits from pundits for a classy performance as he defeated Joshua Ocampo by unanimous decision at London's York Hall on Friday night. The featherweight boxer is now 2-0 in his professional career, following an earlier victory over Elisa Quezada at the same venue. Christian believes the sky is the limit for his potential, having told this newspaper a year ago that he would become world champion one day. Reflecting on Friday night's victory, he said, "Once again, the support from St Albans was truly amazing. It was great to see so many people there. I knew I hurt him in the first round, which made him not want to stand and trade shots with me. I stayed focused and got the win. On to the next one." That next fight could be on a bigger stage after two wins at the intimate Bethnal Green venue, with Christian setting his sights on a bout at the O2 Arena, with eventual dreams of gracing the boxing mecca of Madison Square Garden or a lucrative Saudi Arabia supercard. Despite these big dreams, Christian and Father Stewart have kept their feet planted on the ground, attributing his success to years spent training at St Albans and London Coney ABC. After the fight, Stewart said, "This was a real proud dad moment. I'd like to thank everyone that came to support Christian. We can't wait for the next one." Christian boxed really well against a very experienced opponent, not rushing his work. While this was only Christian's second fight on the professional stage, his opponent was stepping into the ring for the 40th time at this level. Christian recently signed a multi-fight deal with Queensbury Promotions, joining forces with legendary promoter Frank Warren, a man whose stable of fighters includes Tyson Fury. This fight was his first under the Queensbury umbrella and was screened live to a national audience on TNT Sports and Discovery Plus. And there's a great photo of Christian Fetty alongside his trainers after victory at York Hall.
Hello, I'm Sarah. Olympian's next challenge. Harpenden's Olympic phenomenon, Phoebe Gill, will present the trophies to the winners of this month's Great St Albans Challenge. The British 800-metre champion won hearts across the country with her run to the semi-finals in Paris last month and is tipped for big things in the future. Following her return home, she was honoured with a spot on her hometown's underpass mural and will now be presenting trophies to the winners of the St Albans Sherlock Holmes-style treasure hunt. Phoebe will be joined by Daisy Cooper, MP, and High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Annie Brewster, to hand out the silverware. The 17-year-old starlet said, "As a young person from the area, I'm delighted to be supporting the Great St Albans Challenge in support of Youth Talk, a charity that provides a safe and confidential space for local young people to talk and share. Witnessing the effects of lockdown on friends and peers, unstable home environments, the hormonal changes that can influence how we think and feel about ourselves, together with the added pressures of academic achievement and expectations, not to mention the stresses of social media, fueled my interest in mental well-being. As an athlete, I also realised how much of an impact mindset plays on my own performance. So having someone to talk through fears and anxiety is paramount. The services that Youth Talk offer to local young people rely on the local community for their support. The Great St Albans Challenge will be a really exciting, interesting and important afternoon for all ages, and I'm really looking forward to joining in the fun. Taking place on September the 29th, the challenge will be GPS-led, with participants using their mobile phones to find hotspots to complete tasks throughout the day. Raising money for Youth Talk, The event aims to show off the city's landmarks while aiding a good cause. More than 250 people have already signed up to take part in the event, which will kick off at St Albans Cathedral at 11:30 a.m. before culminating with the prize-giving ceremony at 3:15 p.m. The day is suitable for all ages and teams can be registered at greatstalbanschallenge.org.uk.
Hi, this is Liz. My first recording today is about Batchford Hall. Batchford Hall is set for a new lease of life after plans to turn the former nightclub into a hotel, bar, restaurant and wedding venue were approved. The proposals for the St Albans Manor House were unanimously approved at a meeting of St Albans City and District Council's Development Management Committee. Among those to vote in favour was Councillor Chris Brazier, who said during the meeting, "I'd like to see the building used, and this is an application that can use the building, which is suitable as a wedding venue and a hotel. I find that saves the building from just being neglected, because the nightclub, as you know, has been closed for some time and the building is looking very tired. The historic property is owned by the council and was used as a nightclub for many years, before closing in 2020 at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. It then fell dormant after being used as a vaccination centre. But in November 2023, St Albans District Council announced it had signed a long-term lease with hospitality firm The Oakman Group for its redevelopment, promising to give the building a new lease of life. Plans for a change of use were formally submitted in April, and we'll see the 1800s house become a 16-bedroom hotel, restaurant, bar and wedding venue after internal and external refurbishments."
Pensioners' mission to raise awareness of blood disease. A Harpenden pensioner says he is on a crusade to raise awareness of a rare blood disease 5 years on from his own diagnosis. Bob Dart, 71, was living the high life having retired to Spain when he was struck by vasculitis, a disorder which destroys blood vessels by inflaming them. Bob's condition is known as granulomatosis with polyangiitis, an extremely rare form of the disease which impacts just 3 in 100,000 people. In March 2019, he began to feel unwell, having difficulty getting out of bed, before eventually being unable to stand up at all. He was diagnosed in August 2019 and had to spend £8,000 hiring an ambulance to drive him back to the UK, as he was unable to fly. On Life Since, he said, "It's been so frustrating because nobody's heard of this illness and nobody seems to care about it. Although it's rare, it's still killing people." He highlights the work of the Lauren Currie Twilight Foundation, a charity that supports people like Bob. The charity was set up in the name of Lauren, who died of undiagnosed granulomatosis with polyangiitis at the age of 15. Using their materials, Bob is on a mission to raise awareness of the disease in Hertfordshire. He said, "I continually find that GPs haven't heard of this condition, which makes it an uphill battle. If you have the symptoms of this disease, you are very unlikely to be diagnosed by your GP, which should be your first port of call. To combat this, he's travelled from surgery to surgery, distributing a 4-page brochure which he said he hopes will help raise awareness, saying that, if going around giving out the brochures helps save just one life, I've done my job." Bob regularly has to travel to Cambridge's Addenbrookes Hospital, where to date he has had 15 infusions in a bid to keep his symptoms at bay. Despite all this, he prides himself on keeping a positive outlook, although admits that he's bitter about his situation and the way society treats this illness like it doesn't exist. He is most hurt by the damage the disease has done to his hands, with the condition attacking his fingers and leaving his left index 1/2 inch shorter. "If there is a God, he made this personal because I used to play the guitar," Bob said, "and I can't play anymore because of that left index finger."
St Albans boxer Christian Fetty has hailed the support from his hometown after securing an impressive victory in his second professional fight. Christian, 22, won plaudits from pundits for a classy performance as he defeated Joshua Ocampo by unanimous decision at London's York Hall on Friday night. The featherweight boxer is now 2-0 in his professional career, following an earlier victory over Elisa Quezada at the same venue. Christian believes the sky is the limit for his potential, having told this newspaper a year ago that he would become world champion one day. Reflecting on Friday night's victory, he said, "Once again, the support from St Albans was truly amazing. It was great to see so many people there. I knew I hurt him in the first round, which made him not want to stand and trade shots with me. I stayed focused and got the win. On to the next one." That next fight could be on a bigger stage after two wins at the intimate Bethnal Green venue, with Christian setting his sights on a bout at the O2 Arena, with eventual dreams of gracing the boxing mecca of Madison Square Garden or a lucrative Saudi Arabia supercard. Despite these big dreams, Christian and Father Stewart have kept their feet planted on the ground, attributing his success to years spent training at St Albans and London Coney ABC. After the fight, Stewart said, "This was a real proud dad moment. I'd like to thank everyone that came to support Christian. We can't wait for the next one." Christian boxed really well against a very experienced opponent, not rushing his work. While this was only Christian's second fight on the professional stage, his opponent was stepping into the ring for the 40th time at this level. Christian recently signed a multi-fight deal with Queensbury Promotions, joining forces with legendary promoter Frank Warren, a man whose stable of fighters includes Tyson Fury. This fight was his first under the Queensbury umbrella and was screened live to a national audience on TNT Sports and Discovery Plus. And there's a great photo of Christian Fetty alongside his trainers after victory at York Hall.
Restaurant named as finalist in Top Curry Awards. A St Albans restaurant has been nominated for a prestigious award at the 2024 Prestige Curry Awards. Nouvelle Lounge in Wickham Place, Marshallswick, has made the final shortlist for the Best Restaurant in Southeast England category. The restaurant's been no stranger to success since its opening in 2022, scooping two awards, Restaurant of the Year and Newcomer of the Year, at last year's Enjoy St Albans Food and Drink Festival Awards. Nouvelle Lounge describes itself as a premium Indian restaurant and bar and could be set for regional success after its shortlisting by the Prestige Curry Awards. Asif Iqbal, founder and chairman of the awards, said, "It brings me great joy to see such exceptional talent and dedication being recognised. Owner Mohammed Shuan Choudhury and his team have truly impressed with their outstanding cuisine, impeccable service and unwavering commitment to excellence. This recognition is well deserved and we congratulate them on this significant achievement." Mr. Choudhury, who also owns Samrat in London Road, reacted to the nomination with a post on social media, writing, "This incredible recognition is a testament to our dedicated team and the amazing community that supports us every day." The awards ceremony will take place on October 21st at Watford's Hilton Hotel.
Grade 2 listed 17th century pub goes on the market. A vacant 17th century pub in Brickett Wood is on the market, looking for someone to take it over after almost a decade of lying dormant. The Old Fox in School Lane closed its doors 8 years ago, with two attempts to change its use into a house dismissed by St Albans District Council. Zoopla is now marketing the site with a guide price in the region of £850,000 for an aspiring publican to take the reins. It boasts attractive living space with 4 bedrooms for prospective tenants, as well as 3 good-sized reception areas, a bar, kitchen, store, and men's and women's toilets. The listing highlights its attractive location with good transports to both St Albans and Watford, as well as the M1 and M25. According to estate agents Cassidy and Tate, the Old Fox presents itself to the astute buyer as an outstanding opportunity to enter the hospitality market with its current status as a public house. They add, needing complete refurbishment, the property is Grade 2 listed and could one day be a dream family home of substantial proportions with excellent surroundings. In May, SADC rejected the latest attempt to turn the building into a house. While the listing describes the property as a 4-bed detached house, its current planning status means that it can only be sold with the intent of being used as a pub.
Dog Day Delight for owners and their four-legged friends. Dog owners were delighted by the second annual St Albans Dog Day, which has proved to be a success despite bad weather. The event took over the city centre and Christopher Place shopping centre on September 8th for a day full of dog-friendly activities. Market regulars Chilton Pet provided puppuccino and dog-friendly whipped cream with pate and fish sprinkles. Over at Christopher Place, there were free dog training sessions with a different dog, and visitors got a chance to make a free rope dog toy out of old jeans with London Road's Jefferson Eco. Throughout the day, visitors were treated to live paintings by graffiti artist Ant Steele and talks from representatives of Pet Blood Bank, who talked about the vital work they do to save pets' lives and the need for donors. Owners were able to take selfies with their dogs in colourful picture frames, which included a kissing booth and a wanted poster. The event was organised by St Albans City Centre Business Improvement District, BID, as part of its campaign to promote the city's status as dog-friendly. St Albans boasts more than 100 businesses that qualify as dog-friendly, ranging from restaurants and cafes to shops and hairdressers. The BID provides these businesses with free window stickers that allow them to show off their dog-friendly status and help people find the places that will accommodate their pets. Vivian Cannon, BID manager, said, "It was great seeing so many dog owners and their four-legged friends come out and enjoy St Albans Dog Day." St Albans regularly features on lists of top dog-friendly places in the UK based on our wonderful green spaces and walks. We hope by also highlighting the wide range of dog-friendly businesses, we can encourage not only resident dog owners, but those visiting, with a recommendation that St Albans becomes a default dog-friendly destination. Last month, Govia Thames Link Railway, GTR, named St Albans as one of the top destinations for dog walkers in the UK as part of its Blue Wag Guide. And there are great pictures of owners with their dogs and dogs with blue toys and in frames, and the artist Ant Steele doing his paintings.
Celebrity Golf Day raises £75,000 for charity. A celebrity golf day in St Albans has raised £75,000 for a children's hospice. Tottenham Hotspur vice-captain James Maddison organised the event called the Maddison Invitational at Centurion Golf Club and handed over the cheque at a recent event. The day saw professional footballers and celebrities, including actor Tom Holland and singer Ollie Mears, taking part. The funds raised were handed over to Noah's Ark Children's Hospice, Tottenham Hotspur's official charity partner since 2016. Noah's Ark provides support for children with life-limiting or life-threatening conditions. Speaking in May, James Maddison said, "I was blown away following my recent visit to Noah's Ark by the amazing work done by the charity and the support it receives from the club." And there's a great picture here where Spurs' James Madison handed over the cheque to the chief exec of Noah's Ark Children's Hospice, Sophie Andrews, OBE.
Eligibility for pension credit. June Chapman of Citizens Advice, St Albans District, offers advice on how to find out if you are eligible for pension credit, which helps those on a low income. As you may have heard, the government has announced that the winter fuel payments, which were previously paid to everyone who'd reach pension age, will, in the future, only be paid to people who are in receipt of pension credit or certain other benefits. The winter fuel payment is an annual tax-free payment made to help older people with their heating costs. In 2023 to 24, most people who were born before September the 25th, 1957, and who lived in the UK were eligible to receive it. In 2024 to 25, the winter fuel payment will be £200 or £300, depending on the age of the recipient and who they're living with. And it will be available to people who were born before September the 23rd, 1958. However, the big change is that you will only be eligible for a payment if you are receiving one of the following benefits: pension credit, universal credit, income support, income-based job seekers allowance, or income-based employment and support allowance. With the exception of pension credit, people of pension age only receive those benefits if they're living with someone of working age. So for most pensioners, this means that they will only receive a winter fuel payment if they receive pension credit. This means it's more important than ever to check whether you are eligible for pension credit. Pension credit is a benefit for people who are over state pension age and who have a low income. It tops up their income to a minimum level, and there are additional payments for people who are carers or who receive certain disability benefits. It is not paid automatically, and it has to be claimed. Unfortunately, the criteria that determine how much pension credit you may receive are complex, but fortunately, the application process is reasonably straightforward. You can apply by going online at gov.uk or by calling the pension service on 0800 99 1234. That's 0800 99 1234. Or you can get a relative or friend to call for you. You will need details of your income, including earnings, pensions and benefits, and of any savings and investments. It's worth applying for pension credit, even if you think you will only get a small award, because qualifying for pension credit means that you're also eligible for a range of other benefits, not just the winter fuel allowance. These could include free TV licences if you're over 75, a reduction in your council tax bill, housing benefit and cold weather payments. Only around 2 in 3 people who are eligible for pension credit currently claim it. So across the UK, as many as 750,000 are missing out. If you think you might be one of them, the changes to winter fuel payments makes now the time to find out. If you need further help tailored to your particular situation, Citizens Advice can offer you independent and confidential support. In St Albans, we can be reached on 01727 811118. That's 01727 811118 from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Monday to Thursday and 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday. Or you can call the Hearts Advice line on 0800 144 8848. That's 0800 144 8848 between 10 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Monday to Wednesday and 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday and 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Saturday. If you would prefer a face-to-face appointment, you can find us in the Civic Centre on weekday mornings from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Local plan timetable to be sped up after Labour election win. Councillors are said to speed up the development of the St Albans local plan after the new government signalled its intent to ramp up house building. The long-awaited local plan was due to be submitted by April 2025, with stakeholders on all sides awaiting confirmation of where the council intended to build the new homes that many feel are needed. But following July's general election, house building has been turned on its head by the election of a Labour government that says councils have a moral imperative to build more homes, announcing a return of housing targets that could see the number of new homes in St Albans doubled. In light of this, the authority has announced an accelerated timetable for the local plan, with a crunch meeting of the Planning, Policy and Climate Committee brought forward to September the 23rd. Following a six-week consultation, this timetable could see the plan sent to Westminster for scrutiny by the end of November. The council say that they have made this decision to get its ducks in a row and mount a defence of the city's greenbelt, much of which is being eyed up by developers. It also says that there is an urgent need for new homes in the city, adding to the need to submit the plan sooner. Council leader, Councillor Paul de Court, said the council must have a robust new local plan in place as soon as possible, especially given the government's proposed reforms. A vast amount of work has been done over the last 3 years to bring us to the point where we have sites that could provide the 15,000 homes for this district that we were required to put forward. By bringing forward the timetable for the local plan, the council has the best chance of getting a new local plan agreed ahead of the government's new deadline. This will set the strategic foundation needed both to defend St Albans districts from ad hoc building on the Green Belt and to set out the policies that will mean any future developments meet strict guidelines for sustainable development. But Councillor Matt Cowley, Harpenden South, deputy leader of the council's Conservative group, said, "After years of dither and delay from the Lib Dems on the local plan that have created a housing emergency and left our green belt vulnerable to speculative development, we now see that for what it was, a political choice. They have repeatedly failed to take decisive action on the difficult conversations they need to have, knowing that all along they had the ability to speed up that process. Our district deserves better." Further reaction came from the leader of the council's Labour group, Councillor Emma Turnbull, London Colney, who said the council's current plan chose to prioritise green belt development over brownfield and allocated less than 1% of homes onto grey belt locations. "We were elected on a pledge to protect the London Colney Knapsbury Park Green Belt, and we will oppose any proposal that does not give additional protection to our environment. The council must do better."
School returned to see surge in calls. The NSPCC's Childline service is anticipating a surge of contacts over the next few weeks from children worried about returning to school. As children start new terms or new schools, the children's charity said 2,283 counselling sessions were delivered by Childline to children worried about school last year. More than a third of these took place in August and September, and more than half were with 12 to 15-year-olds. Concerns included starting at a new school or college, the challenge of making new friends, and being worried about how others might react to how their appearances have changed over the summer. Some neurodivergent pupils said they were worried about being overstimulated at school, while others said they were worried about new teachers, a different commute, or afraid of getting lost or being late. One teenage girl told Childline, "I'm not looking forward to the new term. The bus journey to school is exhausting and I don't have the energy to do anything after classes. I'm also stressing out I'll have to pick my GCSE, but I've no idea what I want to do." Sean Friel, Childline director, said, "Whilst for some children going back to school can be an exciting return to a routine, learning and seeing their friends, for others they may feel anxious or apprehensive. School should be a place where children can be comfortable and reach their full potential. Whilst it's a normal part of growing up to have these worries, young people should feel supported in working through them. Parents can encourage children to create a list of their worries, then talk through their concerns and look at positives. They also can remind children that adjustment can take time and they can always talk to a safe adult about their worries." Childline counsellors are available on 0800 1111 or childline.org.uk. And there's a lovely picture of a very warm Childline supporter on the phone.
This next article comes under the banner of the NSPCC, our 2024 charity. And it's headed "Survivors of Abuse in Epic Charity Trek." Team Uprising, a group of men and women, including abuse survivors from across the UK, climbed Mount Everest to raise £48,106 for the NSPCC. Giles Moffat, who suffered abuse as a boy at Edinburgh Academy, led the 11-strong group to Nepal to trek to base camp. Giles, 51, his climbing companion Andrew Leslie, and three guides continued further up the mountain in a bid to reach the summit. Sadly, Giles became seriously unwell at altitude, and despite a second attempt to climb the Khumbu Icefall, he was forced to turn back. Giles said he was happy the challenge raised awareness of the impact of child abuse and brought in funds for the NSPCC. Giles said, "11 of us made it to base camp and one of us made it to the summit with support from our Sherpa guides. Most importantly, everyone made it back safely. Out of evil, much good has come."
Rollicking musical ends Open Air Festival. Madeleine Burton reviews The Highwayman musical. The Highwayman stood and delivered a pistol-packing finale to the Roman Theatre Open Air Festival. A joint production between OVO, founders of the festival, and the Norwich Theatre, The Highwayman is a new musical by Kitty Morgan. Based on the poem The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes, it demonstrates life in the 17th century in riotous fashion and demonstrates how little some aspects have changed today. The play tells the story of highwayman Claude Duval, who, like so many gentlemen of the road, paid for his crimes with his life. It focuses not just on Duval's law-breaking occupation, but also his love life, particularly with barmaid and heartbroken mother, Bess. It is a rollicking musical, packed with memorable songs, some witty and fun, others sad and emotional. Directed by OVO's founder, Adam Nichols, the themes that run parallel to today include the desire to climb up in the world and are seamlessly introduced. Adam has come a long way from those early days of OVO, where the plays were performed in a back room in a St Albans city centre bookshop. He is now, quite rightly, regarded as a top-flight director himself, with a talent for all forms of theatre, from musicals to Shakespeare. The Highwayman only serves to reinforce that accolade. Kevin Wathen is perfectly cast in the role of Duval, a roguish highwayman with an eye for the ladies, and yet still able to care for his daughter Peggy, played convincingly by Natasha Spencer-Levy. He is at risk at times of being overshadowed by Guido Garcia Luechas as his friend and partner in crime, Thomas French, a character perhaps wisely who does not appear in the poem. It is a much smaller role, and one could argue that it's an unnecessary one, but imbued as ever by Guido's flair for exaggeration and comedy. And Jocelyn Ryder, making her OVO debut as Bess, is at her best when singing about her heartbreak at the loss of her child. A truly moving moment. As ever, the remainder of the cast were excellent, with many showing their musical skills playing instruments on stage. They were backed by musical director Adam Morris, whose piano playing throughout was exemplary and carried the production along. And so the Highwayman gallops away into the sunset of another open-air festival, over for this year, but not forgotten.
From Summer to Winter Fuel. This is a piece by the MP for Harpenden and Berkhamsted, Victoria Collins. Over the summer, I thoroughly enjoyed my listening tour of the wonderful constituency I'm so proud to represent. I travelled to every corner, from Harpenden to Berkhamsted, Tring to Redbourne, Flamstead to Wheathampstead, and Potten End to Jersey Farm. I met inspirational staff and volunteers from dozens of local organisations, and I spoke to hundreds of residents about the issues which matter to them most. As ever, health and social care, the cost of living, and sewage were big concerns. Those subjects are major priorities for me. But one urgent issue came up on doorstep after doorstep, and that's the government plan to cut the winter fuel allowance. Local pensioners and their families are very worried about how they'll now afford their energy bills this winter. This comes as an estimated 17,265 elderly people in Harpenden, Berkhamsted and across my constituency are at risk of losing the £300 payment, which helps with heating bills in the cold winter months. According to research by Age UK, 2 million pensioners nationally will now struggle to pay to heat their homes. Stripping support from so many of the poorest in our society this winter, just when energy bills are set to rise, is simply the wrong thing to do. That's why my party, the Liberal Democrats, will strive to prevent the cuts. We tabled a Commons motion to block the government's plan and preserve the current system of universal winter fuel payments for pensioner households. It's a busy time in Parliament. Last week, I spoke up for local families experiencing immense stress, partly due to the funding crisis in special educational needs and disabilities. Hertfordshire has the third lowest funding per head in the country for high needs, something which urgently needs to change. I also voted for our party's plan to make life easier for Harpenden and Berkhamsted's commuters by introducing an annual report on making rail tickets cheaper and simpler. Sadly, the government blocked it. I campaigned in the general election on the promise of offering you a fair deal, and now I'm in Parliament, I'm determined to use my voice and vote to achieve just that.
Cotton Mill Community Meadows accidentally cut. Contractors responsible for managing outdoor spaces in St Albans have confirmed a community meadow was accidentally mown down for a second year. Both in 2023 and at the end of August this year, John O'Connor Grounds Management Limited accidentally cut down the grass in an area near Crichton Avenue in Cotton Mill. The space is run by volunteers from Grow Community Sopwell, who obtained permission from the District Council 2 years ago. Addressing last night's meeting of the District Council's Public Realm Committee, John O'Connor Operations Director Joe Howarth said that the company made a lot of changes to ensure it would not happen again. Mr. Howarth's explanation is that some residents approached an operator asking for the grass to be cut. Thinking it was the right thing to do for the community, he cut the grass, repeating the mistakes of last year. Mr. Howarth said, "This is obviously very disappointing for the company and for myself. We're going to work with the residents there and learn about these areas and only take instructions from council officers and not the public." He promised that going forward, the company would work hard to get it right and form a better relationship with residents.
This next article comes under the banner of the NSPCC, our 2024 charity. and it's headed Survivors of Abuse in Epic Charity Trek. Team Uprising, a group of men and women, including abuse survivors from across the UK, climbed Mount Everest to raise £48,106 for the NSPCC. Giles Moffat, who suffered abuse as a boy at Edinburgh Academy, led the 11-strong group to Nepal to trek to base camp. Giles, 51, his climbing companion Andrew Leslie, and three guides continued further up the mountain in a bid to reach the summit. Sadly, Giles became seriously unwell at altitude, and despite a second attempt to climb the Khumbu Icefall, he was forced to turn back. Giles said he was happy the challenge raised awareness of the impact of child abuse and brought in funds for the NSPCC. Giles said, 11 of us made it to base camp and one of us made it to the summit with support from our Sherpa guides. Most importantly, everyone made it back safely. Out of evil, much good has come.
How did your MP vote on the winter fuel payment cut? St Albans and Harpenden's MPs have spoken out against the government's decision to remove the winter fuel payment from all but the most vulnerable pensioners. On Wednesday the 10th of September, Parliament voted to cut the annual £300 state benefit by a margin of 348 to 228, despite strong opposition. Labour say the move is a difficult but necessary one, claiming they've been left with no choice by the previous Conservative government. Liberal Democrat MPs voted against the bill, including Deputy Leader and MP for St Albans, Daisy Cooper. She said, "Whilst there are undoubtedly some wealthier pensioners who readily admit that they don't need the help, introducing such tight restrictions on eligibility will leave millions of struggling pensioners without the support that they need this winter. I'm acutely aware that many St Albans residents are very concerned about this proposed cut and have already suffered hugely through the cost of living crisis. There's no doubt that the Conservatives have left our economy in a terrible state and failed to tackle the worst cost of living crisis in a generation. But there are plenty of alternatives for the government to consider, from keeping the universal benefit and taxing it, to removing the universal nature of the benefit but expanding eligibility for the pension credit. We cannot stand by and allow support to be revoked from some of the most vulnerable members of society, and I will continue to push the government to introduce a fairer alternative to this cut." Research from charity Age UK has found that 14,127 pensioners in St Albans and 17,265 in the Harpenden and Berkhamsted constituency are at risk of losing the payment this winter. Harpenden's MP Victoria Collins said, "Since the government announced these plans to cut the winter fuel payments, a number of residents have contacted me to raise concerns about how they will cope with the soaring energy bills this winter. This new government must undoubtedly clear up the dire state that the Conservatives left the public finances in, but now is not the time to be cutting to support to some of the most vulnerable members of our society. The government say the changes will save the country £1.4 billion this year."
St Albans is the best place to live in Hertfordshire, according to a poll of Muddy Stiletto's readers. Readers of the popular lifestyle website were asked to rank Hertfordshire locations, and the verdict is in, with St Albans taking the crown ahead of Tring and Hitchin. St Albans won over voters thanks to its rich Roman history, speedy London commute, excellent shopping and fantastic foodie scene, which creates a lively high street and buzzy market town vibe. Voting took place between July the 30th and August the 15th this year, with each reader having one vote. Readers were provided with a wealth of information to help inform their votes, including house prices, a list of schools in the area, and a guide to the culture of the city. St Albans High School for Girls, St Columba's College, and Beechwood Park were flagged as some of the best schools in the area, while readers were also impressed by the city's strong transport links to London and reputation as a commuter hotspot. Hero Brown, founder and editor-in-chief of Muddy Stilettos, said, "When people move home, they're searching for more than just a house. They want to find a new lifestyle that works for them. It's hard to be confident on whether a location is the right place for you, but we've built our reputation on having first-hand knowledge on the in-the-know places to live and places to go. This reader vote gives a truly independent view on the towns and villages with the most popular postcodes, schools, restaurants and amenities." James Cleland, head of country business at Knight Frank, which partnered with Muddy Stilettos on the poll, said, "When it comes to where to live, more than ever people want a vibrant and tight-knit community. It's a trend that deepened during the pandemic and is likely to remain a leading factor for those who like to relocate."
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, September 14th. And Slow Rise, a bread-making adventure, is an account of a search for the perfect bread made from ancient wheat grains. Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 in the evening. There's live coverage of the last night of the proms, must be the end of summer, Radio 3, 7 p.m. And in the series Archive on 4, Bowie in Berlin explores the truth behind the myths of David Bowie's years in Berlin from 76 to 78. Radio 4, Saturday evening, 8 o'clock. Sunday, September 15th. And in the series The Reunion, Kirsty Walk brings together key figures from the reality TV show Castaway 2000, which took 36 people to a remote Scottish island for a year to create a self-sufficient community. Radio 4, 10 o'clock, Sunday morning. The guest in Private Passions is author Anne Cleves, creator of Vera and Shetland, whose musical choices include works by Britten and Elgar, as well as fiddle playing from the Shetland Islands. Radio 3 for this at 12 noon. There's another chance to hear the first five parts of Crossrigs, the Scottish family drama by Jane and Mary Fidlinter, on Radio 4 Extra at 7 in the morning, 12:30 at lunchtime or 6:30 p.m. The series continues every day from Monday. Back to Sunday, and Steel Dragons explores the closure of Port Talbot Steelworks' last remaining blast furnace and its potential impact on South Wales, the UK and the world. Radio 4, Sunday, September 15th, 1:30 in the afternoon. The Silent Scream is an alien invasion adventure by Wally K. Daly, part one of three, Radio 4 Extra at 4:30. Alternatively, Brain of Britain, the quiz show, continues on Radio 4 at 4:30. And from our own correspondent, is on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. On to programmes then, that are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. So working week, Monday to Friday, same time, same radio station, every day. Caribbean Mystery is a dramatisation of Agatha Christie's novel, starring June Whitfield as Miss Marple. Radio 4 Extra at 11 in the morning, 5 p.m. Book of the Week is The Siege by Ben McIntyre, telling the inside story of the infamous 1980 siege on the Iranian embassy in London. Radio 4 for this, Monday to Friday, 11:45 in the morning. The reading of Crossrigs continues on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 a.m, 1:30 in the afternoon or 7:30 at night. Uncharted with Hannah Fry continues her journeys of data and discovery on Radio 4 all week, every day, 1:45 p.m. Five stories in contention for this year's BBC National Short Story Award are read on Radio 4 at 3:30 all week, Monday to Friday. Our composer of the week, after the proms, probably aptly, Gustav Holst, 1874-1934, Radio 3, every day, 4 o'clock. And the Book of Bedtime is Still Lives, five short stories based on classical still life images by John McGregor, a previous winner of the Short Story Award. Radio 4, every day this week, 10:45 at night. On to the individual programmes then, to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, September 16th. Cafe Hope is a new series celebrating the people making our world a better place. The first part is on Radio 4 at 9:45 Monday morning. The subject of Great Lives is Jane Morris, the largely unknown wife of William Morris, who inspired the works of Gabriel Dante Rossetti and has underappreciated influence on art history. Radio 4 for this, Monday afternoon at 3. A 1963 edition of Frankly Speaking is an interview with Hollywood star Betty Davis. Radio 4 Extra at 4 o'clock. And in a new series of Just a Minute, Sue Perkins is the host and Stephen Fry among the panellists. Radio 4, Monday night, 6:30. Tuesday, September 17th, and people fixing the world. Here's how healthcare is being made available to people around the world. BBC World Service for this, 8:05 in the morning or 3:05 in the afternoon. Half Lives is a drama in which a scientist and linguist wrestle with the legacy of nuclear power and how to warn future generations about the dangers of waste. Radio 4, 2:15 on Tuesday afternoon. Jamaica Inn by Daphne du Maurier is serialised in four parts, starting on Tuesday and continuing right through till Friday. Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 9 o'clock at night. Back to Tuesday and Frankie Vaughan and the Live Gang show. Here's from Glaswegian locals about the 50s and 60s chart star and actor who in the late 1960s got rival gang leaders to shake hands. Radio 4 Extra at 4:30 on Tuesday. And Peter White presents his regular programme In Touch, news and features for the blind and partially sighted. Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. Tuesday. Wednesday, September 18th, and The Missing Hancocks presents re-recording of the lost 1955 Hancocks half-hour episode, Prime Minister Hancock, starring Kevin McNally. Radio 4 Extra, 7:30 in the morning if you like a laugh to wake up to, 12:30 at lunchtime or 6:30 at night. Choral Evensong comes from Gloucester Cathedral to mark the 150th anniversary of the birth of Gustav Holst. Radio 3 at 3. In Meeting Myself Coming Back, former MP Claire Short looks back through her life as captured in the BBC archive. On Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m. Bach's St Matthew's Passion, in the history-changing version by Felix Mendelssohn, can be heard in a recording from the Usher Hall as part of the Edinburgh Festival on Radio 3, Wednesday evening, 7:30. Thursday, September 19th, in Our Time, has a discussion about the two-time British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. Radio 4, 9 o'clock in the morning. Glued Up, the sticky story of humanity, explores how glues hold the world together and how they've shaped human history since the dawn of civilization. The first episode explores adhesives dating back to 190,000 years, which allowed people to invent and make the first tools. Radio 4 for this fascinating programme. Don't get stuck on it, though. Thursday, 9:45 a.m. Drama is the ballad of Bobby Sands, imagining the final days of the MP and IRA hunger strike in a play about political and religious conviction, grief and a mother's love. Radio 4, 2:15. Open Country meets a group of 12 and 13-year-olds who are all caring responsibilities for a family member at home, but who are spending a night camping on Dartmoor this summer. Radio 4, 3 o'clock for Open Country. And lastly, for Thursday, the Today podcast has Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson's take on the big news stories of the week. It's available on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. or on BBC Sounds. Finally, Friday, September 20th, and Soul Music marks the 90th anniversary of the birth of Peter Maxwell Davis, with a programme of personal stories about his 1980 work, Farewell to Stromness, written as a protest against uranium mining in Orkney. Radio 4 Extra, 10 in the morning. The food programme Nuts About Nuts asks, where do nuts come from and are they really that good for you? Radio 4, 11 a.m. Paul Merton's guest in Room 101 is the comedian and comedy writer Phil Wang. On Radio 4 Extra at 1 p.m. or 7 p.m. And the semi-finals of the Leeds Piano Festival can be heard on Radio 3 at 7:30 on Friday night. Finally, Americast explores the cultural and social stories defining political debate in the United States on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. on Friday night, or also available on BBC Sounds. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Hello again. It's time for the audio described television programmes for the week starting Saturday the 14th and ending Friday the 20th of September 2024. Compiled by John B. and read by John C. And we'll start with Saturday. Bargain Hunt is in Shrewsbury at 1:15 p.m. on BBC One. Take a culinary trip down under with A Cook Abroad, Rick Stein's Australia, on BBC Two at 12 noon. Lorraine makes sophisticated dishes for parties in Lorraine's Fast, Fresh and Easy Food on BBC Two at 1 o'clock. And continuing the cookery theme, James arrives in L'Île sur la Sorgue in southeastern France. Follow how he gets on in James Martin's French Adventure on ITV1 at 12:40. There's entertainment in Birmingham to celebrate the end of the games in Paris. Paralympics GB Homecoming is on Channel 4 at 5:30. You can return to the dance floor as the new series of Strictly Come Dancing starts, pairing the new celebrities with their professional partners. Find out who's with whom at 7:20 tonight on BBC One. Adjoin Anode, Adrian Childs and Trevor Nelson say what they see in Celebrity Catchphrase on ITV One at 7:30. Viking nobleman Amleth is in exile and spends his time bent on pursuing revenge against his uncle Fjonir, who murdered his father. When Amleth hears of Fjonir's exile in the Icelandic wilderness, Amleth spies his chance. The Northman, a 5-star rated film, is on Channel 4 at 9. And so to Sunday the 15th. Bargain Hunt is at the Three Counties Showground in Malvern. Find out how the teams get on at 12:15 on BBC One. Simon revisits some of his journeys around the world, starting with a Burmese undercover human rights campaigner. Incredible Journeys with Simon Reeve is on BBC Two at 7. The flood finally arrives in the Okavango Delta, bringing prey and new challenges for the big cats. Part 4 of Big Cats 24/7 is on BBC Two at 8. Also at 8, the crime drama asks, Are You Dead? Workmen working in Hove Lagoon unearth a dark secret that was meant to stay buried for good. Meanwhile, in what appears to be an isolated incident, it has a chilling link to the secret in the lagoon. Grace is on ITV1 at 8 tonight. If you would like to visit Sierra Leone, then follow Romesh as he ventures through the spectacular national parks in search of rare wildlife. The Misadventures of Ramesh Ranganathan on BBC2 at 9. Alternatively, there's a new thriller starting at 9. A train is taken over by cyber terrorists during an overnight journey from Glasgow to London. Night Sleeper is on BBC One at 9. There's a documentary following Palestinians and Israelis affected by the war in Gaza and the October 7th attacks. Israel and Gaza Into the Abyss is on Channel 4 at 10:20 tonight. And now for programs that are on at the same time and the same channel each weekday. All the following programs are on BBC One. Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15. Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Doctors at 2 p.m, but not on Friday. Robson Green's Weekend Escapes at 2:30. Escape to the Country at 3 p.m. And now for the other channels, Dickinson's Real Deal on ITV1 at 2 p.m, Great British Railway Journeys on BBC2 at 6:30, but at 6:45 on Friday. Heartbeat, two episodes starting at 5:50 and 6:55 on ITV3. And all the soaps are in their usual places at their usual times. Looking now at individual programmes starting with Monday the 16th of September. A documentary about a bogus travel agent who conned holidaymakers and her own family, The Sunshine Scammer, is tonight's episode of The Big Cases on BBC Two at 7. How does homegrown aubergine with roast chicken sound? That's one suggestion on tonight's Jamie, What to Eat This Week, Autumn, on Channel 4 at 8. Lots of choice at 9. The cyber attack stops Abby from seeing obstacles in the sleeper's path in tonight's Night Sleeper on BBC One. There's a new documentary which should interest the musical amongst us, part 1 of 3 on the life of Mozart, Rise of a Genius, on BBC Two. What about a reality show? The dating show where grown-up children nominate their single parents to give them second chance at love, My Mum, Your Dad, is on ITV One, again at 9. And finally, on Channel 5, a mystery drama in which three women become suspicious about the disappearance of their sister-in-law and begin to search for answers. The Wives, also at 9 o'clock on Channel 5. Freya and Abe go for their first weekend away together in We Might Regret This. It's on BBC Two at 10 tonight. Tuesday the 17th. There are only 5 celebrities left, and they must put their own twist on a dish inspired by a well-known chef. Then the final 4 take charge of lunch on the British Pullman train. Celebrity MasterChef at 8 p.m. on BBC One. At 8, we follow a group of amateur designers as they create women's wear clothing for a major high street retailer and hopefully win a job there. M&S Dress the Nation is on ITV One at 8. Alice Roberts visits a farmer's field in Rutland to view evidence of a Roman barn conversion featuring a 3-room spa and in-wall central heating. Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 8. Head teacher Steve Savage updates the school rules before learning one of the pupils has serious issues. Waterloo Road continues at 9 on BBC One. There's another episode of My Mum, Your Dad at 9 o'clock on ITV One. Beth escapes from Charlie's apartment and tells Natasha and Sylvie about the bag she found. The Wives continues on Channel 5 at 9. Former White House staff reveal how former President Trump tried to remain in office after his 2020 election defeat. Trump's Heist, The President Who Wouldn't Lose, on Channel 4 at 9 o'clock. And Part 2 is on tomorrow at the same time. When Ash doesn't turn up for dinner, Gordon searches around Sydney to find her. Colin from Accounts continues on BBC Two at 10. And so on to Wednesday, 28th. A drag queen's first pair of high heels, a camera from Vietnam, a wooden mobile in the shape of a flying toucan, and a leather suitcase are all in need of help from the repair shop tonight at 8 on BBC One. In the last part, Chris Packham explores how the twists in Earth's story enable humans to go from being part of nature to controlling it, and what can be learned before it's too late. Earth concludes on BBC Two at 8. It's the final leg, and there's only 39 minutes between the teams. The race leaders, Cola and Mary Ellen, have just 10% of their budget left. Who will win this celebrity race across the world? On BBC One at 9. Have you been watching how an actor became president? the story concludes with President Zelensky and his First Lady, Olena, and tells of the realities of living through war and revealing what happened during the Russian invasion. The Zelensky story concludes at 9 on BBC Two. My Mum, Your Dad continues on ITV One at 9. Trump's Heist, The President Who Wouldn't Lose, concludes at 9 on Channel 4. Ash and Gordon head to Yass for a weekend with the Crap family. Sounds like fun. And Colin from Accounts is on BBC Two at 10. Thursday the 19th. The finalist's first brief is to deliver a perfect dish inspired by someone special. Those successful head to the 5-star Cowarth Park Hotel in Berkshire. Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One at 8. What's it like in a luxury hotel built into a network of ancient caves? Monica and Rob find out when they visit the Argos in Cappadocia in Turkey. Amazing Hotels, Life Behind the Lobby is on BBC Two at 8. Ollie Murs explores his Latvian roots, discovering that his great-grandparents were circus performers. You can find out more in Who Do You Think You Are on BBC One at 9. And My Mum, Your Dad continues on ITV One at 9. There's a new series starting on Channel 5. It's 1941. Mrs. Hall and Helen attend a meeting about the war effort while Siegfried is taking up the slack. All Creatures Great and Small begins its fifth series at 9 on Channel 5. In June 2023, an overloaded trawler flips over in front of a Greek Coast Guard patrol boat. More than 600 men, women and children are killed. The survivors suggest that the Greek Coast Guard is at fault, something the Greek authorities deny. But what is the truth? Dead calm, killing in the Med, on BBC Two at 9, sets out to expose the truth of this terrible tragedy. And finally to Friday, the 20th of September. The body of a high-level government official secretary is found at the bottom of a staircase in Sister Boniface Mysteries on BBC One at 2 p.m. Lady Felicia lands in hospital in the first story tonight from Father Brown on the UN Drama Channel at 8. And the priest investigates an apparent suicide in the second story at 9 on the UN Drama Channel. 20 famous faces began the journey to become the champion, and only 3 remain. The final task is to cook and present the ultimate dinner party menu. Who will impress enough to become the champion? Find out in the final of Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One at 9. And My Mum, Your Dad continues on ITV One at 9. Derek surprises Malcolm with an escape room for his birthday, while Xander discovers Gemma in labour. The concluding part of Daddy Issues is on BBC One at 9:30. How about ending the week with a crime drama? An English tailor moves from Savile Row to Chicago, where he has no choice but to make clothes for a family of vicious gangsters. When a turf war erupts, he realizes he will need his wits about him if he is to survive. The Outfit is the late film on BBC One, starting at 10:40. I hope you find something of interest this week, and I'll be with you again next time for more information on the ADTV schedule.
DNF Soundings. Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T. And the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0 and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Jeff, and here he is.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to 10 Today, Series 2, Session Number 3. These are short 10-minute physical activity routines which will get you moving and stretching. They're great for your health, including boosting your mood. And very importantly, they are designed to support your everyday movements, your functional fitness, your flexibility, balance and mobility, such as when you have to reach up, turn, bend down and so on. These simple routines will help you with that. Just take them at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, then just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either sitting down or standing up. So just do whichever feels good for you today. When lifting your arms or knees, only go as far as is comfortable. If you have any problems with your knees or hips, take care not to twist them during the movements. It can also help to pull in your tummy when you are bending your back and just breathe normally throughout these activities. We want you all to do these activities safely. You're responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the sessions. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember you agree to take part at your own risk. If you're remaining seated, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair, preferably one without arms, such as a dining chair, so that you can sit upright, with a straight back and with your feet flat on the floor. If you're standing, just step your feet hip width apart, relax your shoulders and take a good strong stance. And you might want to have a sturdy chair nearby to hold on for something for balance. We hope you enjoy 10 today, so we're just going to start with a warm-up. You're just going to quickly tap or pat different parts of your body. So briefly tap along each arm, one at a time, in different places. Your upper arm, your forearm, and your wrist. Do the same on both arms. Then pat the top of both legs, just quickly tapping up and down your legs in various places towards your knees for a few seconds. You should be nicely warmed up by now and ready to move. So we're going to start with butterfly wings. In the usual starting position, with your feet hip width apart and shoulders relaxed, lift both arms to shoulder height and bend your elbows so that one is pointing to the left and one to the right, with your hands facing each other in front of your chest. Now roll your shoulders backwards, letting your arms naturally follow the movement. If you're standing, you can bend your knees slightly at the same time. If you're sitting, you can press down through your feet. Continue rolling your shoulders backwards a few times. Then stop and roll your shoulders forwards this time to move your arms. You can make wider, higher circles if you can. Just do a couple more. This is great for your shoulders and arms. Now it's time for look back. Lean forwards and lower both arms down towards the floor, past your knees. Then swing your arms together slowly to the left, sweeping them all the way up to shoulder height if you can, or as high as possible. Raise your head and look up, following your arms with your eyes as they swing up towards your shoulders. Then lower both arms back down, past your legs, and swing them up to the right. So just keep swinging your arms slowly from left to right, going up to the left, coming back down to your legs, and then up to the right, remembering to raise your head and look up as your arms swing up. Keep going for a few more times, a bit further forward if you can. This is another good one for your arms and shoulders, as well as your balance. Next up is kick the ball. If you're standing, you can hold on to something sturdy like a chair for balance. So just raise your right leg and bring your knee up towards your body. Straighten your leg out in front of you as if you're about to kick a ball. Bend it again and return your foot to the floor. Then swap legs, lifting your left foot off the floor this time, bending your knees, and then straightening that leg out in front of you. Pull it back and back down to the floor again. Keep going with this movement, just alternating your legs. So bend leg up, straighten out, pull back, and down again. That's good. A couple more times now, lifting your leg a little bit higher if you can. This is a great one for your balance and core. This next one is called Look Below. Step your feet a bit further apart to take a wider stance. Then lean forward, lowering both arms together towards your feet as far as is comfortable. Push your hands downwards with your palms facing down. Then just make some small circling motions with your hands, moving them outwards in opposite directions, as if you're polishing a table with a cloth in each hand. Straighten up and then lean forwards again. Lower your arms towards your feet and repeat these small circling movements. Do this a few more times, making bigger circles if you can, and with your legs a bit wider. This is another one that's good for your balance and your core muscles. Well done. Now it's time for rustling in the wind. Push both arms straight up above your head and slowly move your arms and wrists just like the branches rustling in the wind. Keep your feet still and facing forward, but turn your upper body to either side, twisting from the hips to get more movement. Keep moving those arms and hands above your head as if they're being swayed by a breeze. Then bring your arms back down by your sides in that comfortable starting position. Now push both arms back up again and do exactly the same thing, moving those arms and hands in a nice rustling motion and turning your upper body from side to side. You can wave a bit more wildly if you want to. This is really good for your arms, shoulders, and balance. Next up is look up to the moon. Start in the usual position with your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed. If you're sitting, you can move forwards in your chair slightly so that you've got a bit more room to move. Just bend forwards, lowering your arms in front of your knees and slowly bring both arms together to the left, bringing them up around shoulder height. Then straighten your arms and put your palms forward in a pushing motion. Bring both arms back down and swing them to the right this time, past your knees again and up to shoulder height. Push from the elbows to straighten your arms. So swing the arms down, bring them back up and push. Do this a few more times on each side, alternating from left to right. Try and swing your arms a bit lower and a bit higher if you can. This is great for your shoulders, arms and core, as well as your balance. That's good work. Now we go into the fight. Step your right foot forward, bending your knee as far as comfortable into a lunge, and make sure your knee isn't reaching past your toes when you look down. Then make a fist and punch your right arm straight in front of you. Pull your arm back slowly towards your body and then punch up at an angle this time. Pull the arm back again and step back. Now change to the left side, stepping your left foot forward, bending at the knee and punching straight out with that left arm. Pull it back towards your body and then punch out at an angle upwards. Pull it back again and step back. Repeat this movement a few more times, alternating from left to right. You can punch out with a bit more power if you can, and with a bit longer lunge. This is so good for your legs and balance as well as your shoulders. Next up is Repulse the Current. Start with a wider stance this time by moving your feet a bit further apart. Point your toes out slightly, and if you're standing, bend your knees. You can also use your arms for balance if you're standing by putting them out in front of you. This is a squat position, ready to work the inner thighs. Now just raise both heels off the floor and lower them back down. So raising up onto the balls of the feet and onto the toes and then back down again. Repeat that up and down movement a few more times, feeling that pull on the inner thighs. Just go a little bit higher onto your toes if you can. This is great for your legs and balance. Well done. The next one is called Knocking the Sky. This is a nice simple movement, just raising a single arm straight above your head with your palm facing up. So starting with the right arm, push it straight up in the air, keeping it as straight as possible, and then bring it back down again to your side. Swap to the left arm and push that one up above your head. Keep it as straight as you can and then bring it back down again. Keep going, alternating those arms from left to right. Try and keep your arms as straight as you can and reach just a little bit higher. It's really good for your chest, arms and wrists. And the last one is Kick Round. If you're standing, you can hold onto a sturdy chair for balance. Start by lifting your left leg with your knee bent to a comfortable height. With your knee leading, move your leg gently outwards to the left side in a circular motion, just as far as your capabilities allow, taking care with your hips. Then bring your foot back to the floor. Switch to the right leg and do exactly the same again. So you're lifting your right leg this time with the knee bent and moving your leg gently towards the right to make a small circle in the air. Repeat this a few more times on each side, alternating your legs each time. Try to lift your leg a little bit higher if it feels comfortable. This is great for your hip movement, legs, and your back. That's all the exercises. Well done. We're just going to finish with a quick shake to cool down. So raise both arms above your head towards the ceiling and just briefly wave your hands and arms in the air. Then lift one leg slightly from the floor if you can. Shake it out in the air for a second or two. Raise the other leg and shake that one out too. Or you can just shake your upper body instead. So that's the end of the session. Great work, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. Doing 10 today, just 3 times a week, can have positive benefits for your physical health and improve your well-being too. It's short, it's fun, and you'll simply feel better, so do keep going.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, I'm Sue, and here are some events that took place this week in the past. On September the 15th, 1830, the Liverpool and Manchester Railway opened. Designed and built by George Stephenson, it was notable for a number of firsts, being the first intercity railway in the world, the first to rely exclusively on locomotives driven by steam, the first to be entirely double track throughout its length, the first to have a true signalling system, and the first to be fully timetabled, and the first to carry mail. It was also notable for claiming the world's first widely reported railway passenger fatality. At the opening, one line was reserved for a special train conveying Prime Minister, the Duke of Wellington, and other distinguished guests. When the train stopped for water near Newton Le Willows, it was easy for passengers to get down and stretch their legs, despite being instructed not to. William Huskinson, the Member of Parliament for Liverpool, decided to alight and stroll alongside the train, and on spotting the Duke, started a conversation. But the rocket was spotted approaching on the other line, and people shouted at Huskinson to get back on the train. He panicked and tried to climb into the carriage, but grabbed the open door, losing his grip as it swung back. He fell between the tracks, and the rocket ran over him, affording him an unwanted place in history.
On September 16th, 1847, William Shakespeare's birthplace in Stratford-upon-Avon was purchased for preservation as a national memorial by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, which promotes the appreciation and study of Shakespeare's works internationally and can lay claim to being the oldest conservation society in Britain. Under the terms of Shakespeare's will, the ownership of the property, an inn and cottage, passed first to his elder daughter Susanna, and then to her only child, Elizabeth. In turn, Elizabeth bequeathed it to Thomas Hart, a descendant of Shakespeare's sister Joan. The Harts remained owners of the whole property until 1806, when it was sold. When it was again put up for sale in 1846, the American showman P.T. Barnum proposed to buy the home and ship it brick by brick to the USA. To purchase the property for the nation, a birthday committee was formed and donors, including Charles Dickens, helped raise £3,000 to buy the property the following year.
September the 17th, 1916. The German fighter pilot, Baron Manfred von Richthofen, known as the Red Baron, scored his first confirmed aerial victory in the skies over Cambrai in France. Afterwards, he contacted a jeweller in Berlin and ordered a silver cup engraved with the date and the type of enemy aircraft. He continued to celebrate each of his victories in the same manner until he had 60 cups, after which the dwindling supply of metal in blockaded Germany meant that silver cups could no longer be supplied. Richthofen discontinued his orders at this stage, rather than accept cups made of base metal. Considered the ace of aces of World War I, von Richthofen was officially credited with 80 air combat victories. A noted tactician and squadron leader, and a fine marksman, he was not, in fact, a spectacular aerobatic pilot. Indeed, initially he appeared to be a below-average flyer who struggled to control his aircraft and crashed during his first flight at the controls.
On September 18th, 1939, the nickname that would become synonymous with William Joyce, the voice of Nazi Germany, was coined. In a newspaper article of 14th of September that year, the radio critic Jonah Barrington of the Daily Express wrote of hearing a gent moaning periodically from Zeeson, who speaks English of the haw-haw, damn it, get out of my way variety. 4 days later, he came up with the infamous nickname Lord Haw-Haw. The voice Barrington heard was probably not Joyce's, but that of Wolf Mittler, a German journalist whose near-flawless English sounded like a caricature of an upper-crust Englishman. However, Mittler was quickly replaced by other broadcasters, and when Joyce became the most prominent broadcaster of Nazi propaganda, the name stuck to him. Joyce himself began to trade on the notoriety of the nickname more than a year later, when he announced himself as William Joyce, otherwise known as Lord Haw-Haw. Convicted in the United Kingdom of high treason in 1945, Joyce was sentenced to death and hanged in Wandsworth Prison in 1946, making him the last person to be executed for treason in the United Kingdom.
On September the 19th, 2021, a volcanic eruption occurred in a forested area known as Cabeza de Vaca in the Cumbre Vieja Ridge on the island of La Palma in the Canaries. Voluminous lava flows quickly reached populated areas downslope, fanning out across settlements and banana plantations, causing an estimated £760 million worth of damage, destroying thousands of buildings and ultimately pouring over steep cliffs into the ocean, where boiling seawater released toxic sulfur dioxide. The lava also enlarged the island at several locations. La Palma is located on the African plate and is currently, along with Tenerife, one of the most volcanically active of the Canary Islands. The spine of Cumbre Vieja, which means Old Summit in Spanish, runs in an approximate north-south direction, comprising the southern half of La Palma, with both the summit ridge and its flanks pockmarked by dozens of craters and cones. Past eruptions, including one in 1949 and 1971, have ranged over the whole 25-kilometre length of the ridge. This latest eruption lasted until the 13th of December, and on the 25th of December, the local government declared the eruption to be over.
On September the 21st, 1995, a miracle involving milk-drinking statues was declared. It began the day before when a worshipper at a temple in southern New Delhi made an offering of milk to a statue of the elephant-headed god Ganesha. When a spoonful of milk from the bowl was held up to the trunk of the statue, the liquid seemed to disappear, apparently taken in by the idol. Word of the event spread quickly, and soon it was claimed that statues of the entire Hindu pantheon in temples all over India were taking in milk, and it was announced that a miracle was occurring. The news spread beyond India, with the same phenomenon reported by Hindu temples in the United Kingdom, Canada, the United Arab Emirates, and Nepal, among other countries. This had a significant effect on the areas around major temples, and many minor temples struggled to deal with the vast increase in numbers, while stores in areas with significant Hindu communities saw a massive jump in sales of milk. But some statues were reported to not be cooperative. Members of the Delhi Stock Exchange tried to feed milk to a Ganesh statue to no avail. Seeking to explain the claims, a team of scientists with India's Ministry of Science and Technology travelled to a temple in New Delhi and made an offering of milk containing a food colouring. The scientists hypothesised that after the milk disappeared from the spoon, it coated the statue beneath where the spoon was placed as a result of capillary action. The surface tension of the milk, pulling the liquid up and out of the spoon before gravity caused it to run down the front of the statue. The milk-drinking effect continued for several more days, but eventually reports tapered off.
Hi, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. This month you have two recordings made by Angel Perez Grandi, who firstly recorded the sounds of rooks at a rookery, and then, assisted by his daughters, barn swallows next to his home address. Enjoy.
On a cool and calm morning in March, I visited Belcoo, a small village wedged between two lakes in County Fermanagh. I was looking to record the sounds of rooks as they build their nests at a well-established rookery, right on the main street. Rooks are infamous for their raucous cawing. Whenever I moved or a car passing by broke the silence, they would advertise it, giving it their whole body with that characteristic bowing and fan-shaped tail movement. But like them or not, the sounds of rooks are intrinsic to the acoustic heritage of the countryside, as Paddy Corrigan, a local angler, kindly spoke to my microphones.
I've been seeing these rooks for years, for the past 30 years. Start carrying their material for their nests on the 1st of March. Every year is the 1st of March. I've been told this from a man that lived beside a rookery all his life. And he claimed if the 1st of March fell on a Sunday, they didn't start until the Monday to build their nests. The crows in the cottage meadow at the moment, they're all nesting here. They do have the rookery here. A lot of them stay here all year round. But there's a island in the lake behind me here where I'm sitting, and thousands of crows goes there every night from all over area. They meet there at night and they roost there at night. But at Mail, outside Belcoo, there's a lay-by. And when the wind is favouring you, you can hear the crows very plain from the island.
Rookeries are usually established in tall trees, sycamore and Scots pine being the favourite types here in Belcoo. Rooks are very sociable birds, which pair for life, and with a proven ability to solve simple problems. They've certainly understood that by setting up their colonies close to humans, they can benefit from sources of food derived from our activities, such as farming, or simply the odd scrap of food we may accidentally drop on the ground.
Although they'll pick off the street, they'll pick off the back of trailers, they'll come right up to your door for food. They can sit on the rooftops of the houses there. No problem with them.
In Irish, rooks are called rúchach, and sometimes also preacon dove, meaning black crow. In the English language, their name takes from their harsh call. But there is a range of other sounds they make around the rookery, from soft mutterings to higher sort of strangled sounding notes. And there's also the loud calls from their cousins, jackdaws, who flock with rooks during the winter months and like to make swooping visits all year round.
To the barn and look at the nests. It makes me think of, like, you know when two of the adults perched on the little wood at the top?
You mean like the bar across?
Yeah.
The barn that keep
them. Yeah,
and they used to always talk to each other, like, chip, 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 chip.
Yeah, just little chat. Yeah. I remember spending summer, like hot summer mornings, or when it was raining even, I used to come into the barn and we'd shelter in there and, like, watch the swallow chicks sometimes.
As I dug through my sound library, I stumbled upon these barn swallows. But it was the sound of the space itself that stopped me on my tracks. It's been a huge year of change for my family, as we've relocated countries and to a certain degree traded lifestyles. I think I've got a good sound of the feeding chicks. Oh, the rain.
Oh,
feeding and rain.
Oh, I like that. I like it when it rains. It's peaceful.
These solos bring me straight back to our cottage in Ireland, the place where we raised four children. Year on year, Solos would return to the barn to make a family, whilst we were making our own in the house next door.
Them actually fighting for the food.
Yeah, you can picture them, the little chickies in the nest waiting for their mum or their dad to come home.
I've actually got the sound of them killing, feeding, insect killing.
Ooh, let's try and... how gruesome.
Let's try and find this. Insects last cry.
It sounds like ripping something in half and yeah. Then eating it.
And then the juices are spilling out.
And then the top bit is still alive.
We took great pride as a family that the Solos would choose our barn to raise their chicks. And it provided healthy entertainment for the children all throughout the summer. Ah, parent chatting to chicks.
Let's
that's
hear
appropriate.
This. Yeah, let's listen.
You have to be good when you grow up. One day you'll be flying on your own.
Yeah. Trust Papa had to teach a little life about, lesson in this.
So it makes me think about you telling us not to watch any more TV.
True, we didn't.
Coincidentally, that year, the Swallows raised four chicks.
I like that. It makes us think a bit like us. When, you know how we used to have an old log fire on rainy days? We used to light it on cold days because it was one of the only ways to heat the house.
The fire?
Yeah.
I remember coming out of the bath with a towel on and just going down to the fire.
You always used to have your back to the fire. You're always blocking it.
Yeah, I was always holding it.
We have now flown the nest ourselves off to new lands. But the echoes of our collective memory as a family will be forever linked to these adventurous small birds.
Hello, my name's Sue. With some of Hart's loveliest countryside and steeped in royal history, King's Langley holds hidden gems for the walker. This feature is from Hertfordshire Life. It's by Liz Hamilton from Hart's campaign to protect rural England, and it's called Hidden Spaces. In early August, I went out with my camera to explore the quiet countryside between King's Langley and Chipperfield. Travelling by train out from London Euston, King's Langley is the next stop after Watford Junction. From the station, the countryside on both sides of the Gade Valley is just a few minutes' walk away. I set out towards Chipperfield, initially on a stretch of the Hertfordshire Way I'm very familiar with, as this is the section I walk regularly to check that all is well. Very soon after leaving King's Langley station, there's a brief glimpse of the River Gade flowing under a footbridge. This fast-flowing stream, which derives its headwater from the underlying chalk aquifer, powered the early industry in the valley, including papermaking, which was developed into a major enterprise by John Dickinson. Less than a third of a mile from the station, I was in open countryside. The buildings of Wayside Farm, which house one of the country's few remaining dairy herds, were behind me as I headed uphill. Once across the footbridge over the A41, I left the Hertfordshire Way to take a slightly more southerly route towards Chipperfield Common, about 2 miles away. With the traffic noise receding, my route took me through an area of new woodland, planted to commemorate the centenary of Hertfordshire County Council's rural estate in 2008. Beyond a complex of farm buildings, I came across one of the loveliest small stretches of the countryside I have encountered in Hertfordshire. Perhaps it felt this way because I had the area to myself, and the sun had come out at last as earlier clouds cleared away. I sat for a while on a grassy bank to watch 6 red kites perform their aerial ballet above the peaceful valley below. Beyond, a short uphill section brought me to another equally tranquil and beautiful view. The King's England volume for Hertfordshire, edited by Arthur Mee and published just before the Second World War, describes the countryside around Chipperfield as a wide and lovely stretch of Hertfordshire and one of the best bits of the country within easy reach of London. Although the M25 now carries its noisy traffic barely more than a mile from this point, I could neither hear nor see the motorway. The valley running gently downhill from this point enclosed a peaceful landscape of woods, hedges and fields. Turning away from the view, I reached the hilltop settlement of Buck's Hill, then headed for Chipperfield Common. Much of the hilltop area I had reached is over 400 feet above sea level. The soils here are poor, and until the last century, the area was sparsely populated with extensive tracts of woodland and grazed common land. Chipperfield Common covers 117 acres. Once part of the Manor of Langley, later King's Langley, a royal possession from the Norman Conquest until 1630, when Charles I sold the manor to pay his debts. In the 20th century, the then lord of the manor gave Chipperfield Common to the local authority on condition that it was managed in consultation with local people. The common has become woodland since grazing ceased in the early 20th century. It is now a popular place to walk, with a number of well-surfaced tracks suitable for wheelchairs and pushchairs. I paused by Apostle's Pond, one of several on the common that were essential to provide water for grazing livestock. The term Apostles reflects the fact that 12 lime trees once stood around the pond's perimeter. Further on, I passed one of 8 veteran Spanish or sweet chestnut trees, believed to date from around 1600. Nearby are 2 Bronze Age tumuli, burial mounds, which are also thought to mark the boundary of territories of that date in the Gade and Chess Valleys. To return to King's Langley, I again followed the route of the Hertfordshire Way for a while, then diverted onto a path heading north. In the hedges, blackberries and elderberries were ripening, and I enjoyed the views looking back the way I had just come towards the wooded ridge of Chipperfield Common. In the first half of the 20th century, as more people owned cars, and electricity was supplied to rural areas for the first time, new housing began to proliferate in the countryside. In the Gade Valley, rows of housing plots bordering the lane sprang up with little planning control. The regulation of such uncontrolled growth was a key reason for the formation of the Campaign to Protect Rural England in 1926, as fears grew that large areas of the countryside would be engulfed. CPRE's campaigning led to the Restriction of Ribbon Development Act, which was finally passed in 1935 and put an end to this type of development, a major victory for the fledgling organisation. The patterns of ribbon development are still very apparent all along this section of the Gade Valley, especially near the railway stations. I walked a short stretch of road bordering by original ribbon development plots, where many of the homes still display classic design features of the interwar period. At the time of the Domesday Book, the Manor of Langley was held by a half-brother of William the Conqueror. The manor was later acquired by Eleanor of Castile, wife of Edward I. After their coronation in 1274, she built a large palace and established a deer park here. Edward II stayed here often with his friends Piers Gaveston and founded a priory nearby. The palace went into decline after a fire in 1431. I took a path which runs close to the site of the former palace, just off Langley Hill, on the western edge of King's Langley, and now occupied by a school. Only a small fragment of the palace has survived, together with part of the priory, which has been incorporated into the school buildings. A cellar built under the palace was discovered in the 1960s when the school was extended. Down the hill in King's Langley village, I was able to visit the parish church of All Saints. Fragments of a 13th century building remain, but most of the church is 15th century, subsequently altered in the 19th and 20th centuries. Outside, the Hertfordshire spike above the tower is typical of many of the county's churches. Inside is the tomb of Edmund of Langley, fifth son of Edward III, who was born and died in King's Langley. He became the first Duke of York and founded the York dynasty. His tomb was moved to this church from the Priory Church up the hill after the dissolution. Some say his tomb was intended for Richard II. There is much more of interest in the church, including a carved Jacobean pulpit with a tester or cover typical of the period. Continuing downhill, I reached the towpath of the Grand Union Canal, which runs close to the gate. Sometimes the two watercourses become one, as the construction of the canal in places swallowed up the river channel. Canal and towpath form a pleasant green corridor between residential parts of the village on one side and industrial premises between the canal and the railway to the east. Here, between 1924 and 1929, a factory was built for the Ovaltine Company in the Art Deco style. The company had set up a small factory here in 1913. Beyond the railway, an egg farm and a dairy farm were established by Ovaltine between 1929 and 1932 as model farms. Both built in half-timbered style, the dairy farm with a thatched roof. The company left King's Langley in 2002 and its buildings have been converted to residential and office use. Near one of the farms, there's a large wind turbine, which you can see from the M25. It was good to be able to walk at will again, with so much to see and enjoy in this area.
Hi, it's Bill again, and I have an article from Hearts Life here about Frederick Sander, who was known as the Orchid King, and it's written by Gillian Thornton. Walk into any high street supermarket, and for a little more than a tenner, you can pick up a small potted orchid, a beautiful gift for any occasion. But when Frederick Sander set up his nursery in St. Albans in 1881, orchids were exotic blooms accessible only to the rich. By the time he died, however, in December 1920, the Orchid King had worked tirelessly for 40 years to develop new species and popularise them, not just among the world's wealthy, but those of more modest means. Sander revolutionised the horticultural world, and yet 100 years on, he is much less well-known in his adopted city, and fellow horticulturalist Sam Ryder, pioneer of penny seed packets and founder of golf's famous Ryder Cup. Frederick was born Heinrich Friedrich Conrad Sander in Bremen on March 4, 1847. His father died when he was 9, and his mother's nursery business clearly fostered her son's love of plants. Her brother, the sculptor Diedrich Krupp, also influenced young Frederick with his tales of overseas travel, and in 1865, aged just 18, Frederick emigrated to England to escape the war between Denmark and Schleswig-Holstein. While working as a nurseryman at James Carter & Company in Forest Hill, he met Benedict Rützel, a Czech explorer and plant collector who needed a reliable UK agent to sell his plants. Frederick was hard-working, honest, and passionate about plants, and in 1875 he left Carter's to set up his own business in St. Albans, buying the George Street premises of Josling's seed merchants, with help from his wife's family. Elizabeth Fernley's father was a wealthy paper manufacturer and landowner. Fueled by the Victorian craze for exotic plants, Rützel shipped huge consignments of tropical species to Frederick's new warehouse near the seed shop, and he marketed them so well that Rützel was able to retire to Prague. Frederick, meanwhile, decided to concentrate on orchids and needed more space, so in 1881 he bought land from Earl Spencer in Camp Road. Here he built a gabled house with bay windows and ornamental cornicing, and set up a 4-acre nursery with some 60 glasshouses. Several of the houses were devoted to seed raising, others to testing and propagating hybrids. To meet the desire of Americans' love of orchids, a nursery in New Jersey followed in the 1880s, managed by one of the plant collectors. But distance proved impractical, and it was sold on in 1896. By then, Frederick had established an even larger orchid nursery, opening at Saint-André near Bruges in Belgium in 1894. The orchid collection alone filled 50 glasshouses, and the addition of azaleas and palm trees, lilies and begonias reputedly made it the largest horticultural establishment in the world. So famous had Frederick become that he even merited a verse in Punch magazine. "Sander of St. Albans, the mighty orchid king, is filling all his boxes for shipment in the spring." Frederick went on to explain why two apparently similar orchids were so different in price. "This one is pale and washy, and the other's deep and rich. The Manchester cotton spinners, who are great buyers, will give 7 shillings and 6 pence for one plant, and hundreds of guineas for the other." He also revealed that his biggest private sale was £16,000, his smallest, 6 pence. Smitten with their beauty, orchid delirium had taken hold, with some collectors sinking fortunes into their collections, seeking the rarest, most beautiful plants. Orchid sales took place in London 4 days a week during the latter years of the 19th century, and some 2 million plants were handled by Sander's Orchids in St. Albans in the 1880s and 90s. The finest ones could fetch thousands of guineas each, and his customers included Queen Victoria and the Queen of Belgium, the Empress of Russia, and Baron Ferdinand de Rothschild. At one time, Frederick employed 23 collectors to search the globe's wild habitats, often working under challenging conditions in rainforest or on mountains. He said there have not been nearly as many deaths as there used to be, Frederick told the Hearts Advertiser reporter. But one poor fellow came to sad grief. He offended the worshippers of a certain god, and the priests poured oil over him and burnt him to death. Clearly not a job for a faint-hearted botanist. Frederick and Elizabeth also had 3 sons, Conrad, Frederick, and Louis, all 3 entering careers in horticulture. But the world was changing. In 1913, their father was honoured with the Belgian insignia of Chevalier of Order of the Crown. But after 50 years of peace in Europe, the invasion of Belgium at the outbreak of the Great War sparked the decline of the Sander Orchids Empire. Louis stayed on in Bruges and tried to save the business, but was forced to escape to Britain. It was a worrying time. Frederick's first grandchild, Philip Moon, died in Arras in 1915, and Louis, signing up on his return to England, was badly gassed at the Battle of the Somme. The Orchid King was to visit his Belgian nursery just once more in 1918, but he was in poor health. On the advice of his doctor, he underwent an operation in Bruges, but died on December 23, 1920, aged 74. His body was brought back to St. Albans, where he was buried at Hatfield Road Cemetery, just a few hundred yards from the site of his beloved home and glass houses, and alongside his son-in-law Henry, who had died in 1904 from consumption. In 1970, Hodder and Stoughton published a biography by St. Albans playwright and author Arthur Swinson, entitled Frederick Sander, the Orchid King. And in 2017, local history group Fleetfield Diaries adopted the rundown family grave, uprooting shrubs and repairing stonework, with help from Burgess Memorials of Hatfield. We just felt that it's important to keep the memory of this world-famous orchidologist alive in the minds of the people of St. Albans, says Liz Jones of Fleetville Diaries. So next time you pick up an orchid with your weekly shop, remember Frederick Sander, his team of intrepid plant hunters and enthusiastic nursery staff. Without them, there would be a little less colour in all our lives. And the article is illustrated with some very beautiful paintings of orchids. by, many of them, by Henry Moon, his son-in-law. We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Sarah, Bob, Jenny and Liz, for the news, Wendy and John for the radio listings, John B and John C for the audio-described TV listings, and TNF Soundings for 10 Today. The Week in History was read by myself and Sue, and the Wildlife Sound Recording Society provided nature's soundings. Next week, Steve will be here with News Extra, but that's all from me in September 2024. We close with a new song on the Great Demonstration, which is to be made on Kersal Moor, September 24th, 1838. By Edward II. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and keep well. For freedom and liberty, now is the cry. To no longer be slaves, but like free men to die. So let us be steady, determined and ready when we meet on Kersal Moor.
The time it has come, the work has begun to